when I learned about the word Anthropocene and learned about what that meant, it's kind of a scary concept that we've now entered the age where human actions and human development have so dramatically changed our environment and our Earth systems that it had to be renamed. It's a scary thing to think about going up against that.
Throughout December of 2024, when temps were in the 40s and the snow refused to fall, I kept hearing from my clients, friends, and family, it's not supposed to be like this. I'm Sarah Aronson, a climate-aware psychotherapist, which means I'm trained to understand the complex psychological distress related to the climate crisis, as well as how best to support coping, adaptation, and transformation in the face of paralyzing anxiety, grief, and change. Most days, I'm able to leave my client struggles within the four walls of my office. But when I started to hear the collective concern about a disappearing winter, I felt it in my bones. I'm an unabashed winter lover, and I rely on snowfall for my mental health during the dark months. One element of climate-aware therapy is helping clients feel less alone and isolated in their experience, and not pathologizing climate-related feelings. Sometimes, it means joining clients with a simple, yeah, me too. So what does it mean when our bodies seem to know that something is off with the seasons? What do we do with all our feelings, including numbness and apathy, within our ever-changing environment while trying to manage the day-to-day? And are we alone in these experiences? In May of 2025, the Clark Fork River running through the middle of Missoula, Montana, was high and quiet in its typical cycle of spring runoff. But the silence would foreshadow an eerie turn of events when weeks later, after almost no rainfall, the river level dropped to 45% of the median historical average, and a giant algae bloom coated the river bottom. By mid-June, it became a topic of daily conversation. The river's bright green. One night after work, on a 90-degree day, I stopped at the river to cool off, and as I dunked in about 14 inches of water, my hands could grip fistfuls of coarse algae. It was disgusting. Between a brown Christmas and a grossly green June, Montana is changing. While these phenomena have always existed, they're becoming more frequent and intense, part of a trend called climate weirding. In season two of Grounding, we're talking to experts, artists, and you about the dissonance of climate change. It's the psychological tension when our thoughts, beliefs, behaviors, and values conflict. Dissonance can look like grabbing a straw, driving an hour to a ski hill, or taking an airplane to see loved ones. We're exploring this friction in order to better understand the times we're living in and how to live well in spite of these compounding stressors. Though we might end up having more questions than answers this season, we're clear that the answer to the central question, are we alone, is unequivocally no. In this episode, we're going back to school to explore how climate change and mental health enter the college classroom. We're going to start by hearing from Peter McDonough, the current director of the nation's first climate change studies program. The University of Montana debuted the very first climate change studies program in the nation in 2009. Peter found out the hard way that mental health is an important component when teaching about climate change, something he didn't really have a framework for. So he brought on a colleague, Jen Robum, who you'll hear later this episode. This episode contains mentions of suicide. If you or someone you know may be experiencing a mental health crisis, contact 988, Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, by dialing or texting 988.
I'm Peter McDonough. I'm the Director of Climate Change Studies at UM. I've been teaching at UM for 10 years now, and longtime teacher, longtime climate nerd.
Can you just define climate nerd?
Climate nerd, yes, the technical OED definition, channeling Scalia here. What does the OED say? Someone who, despite the facts, loves the complexity and nuance and scale and infinite questions with very few answers that something like climate change presents.
Peter, you also have a background in civil and environmental engineering and turned to environmental studies to fill what you felt like was a gap engineering left in your education when it came to climate change. How did you get into this work specifically?
Long story. Windy road. I didn't grow up with any understanding of this. I hadn't, like, I had a very environmentally friendly, environmentally aware, like, consciousness growing up, but not in, like, a direct way. I didn't know there was an environmental movement or that you had to, like, sign up for this and people were hating you if you were part of it.
Where did you grow up?
Wisconsin and Michigan. Look, climate change was never on my radar. Environmentalism as an ism was never on my radar. I did see Al Gore's documentary when it came out in theaters in 2006. I was home from college and it made me angry, but like my university never dealt with it. We never talked about it. So it just never kind of came up again.
If you look at the 10 hottest years ever measured, they've all occurred in the last 14 years. And the hottest of all was 2005.
I assumed, like, oh, it's in the public awareness now. The people who have power and influence will do something because it's their responsibility to do it. I was so naive then. And so I didn't really think about it until I was in the Peace Corps after college and teaching STEM and English and sex ed and stuff like this really, really rural village school. And, you know, Tanzania and this village were like on the front lines of so many environmental issues, like rapid desertification, changing to water cycles, loss of biodiversity, all this stuff that they were like very aware of. They talked about it. They held monthly village meetings about how they were going to, you know, keep their local forest alive while also doing like wood fire harvests, you know, all this stuff that, you know, a village has to deal with. And at the same time, the national curriculum in physics, and I was the physics teacher, required that we teach how energy systems work, like generators, the difference between like fossil fuel and renewables, and then climate change was in the curriculum. The Tanzanian national curriculum in 2000, whatever, it had been in there for a long time, like a decade. It's like they already like were teaching all of their kids about climate change and the US still doesn't. I came back, I went to grad school for energy engineering and climate science, which is what the program offered, those two things in conjunction. And, but it was at Stanford in the Bay Area where the culture was very much like profits, startups, technology, everything is an engineering problem with an engineering solution, including poverty and hunger and global development. And I loved my education there. I loved the energy of that place, but totally lacking in the humanities and the culture of we can solve it because we're like privileged, educated folks from the Bay Area with technology at our hand. Came to Montana after that looking for a more humanities focus. While I was here, I started adjuncting. Teaching while I was a grad student and then just kept adjuncting. And then when my predecessor was ready to step down, I just filed right in behind her.
I wanted Peter to explain the difference between weather and the climate.
Weather is what's happening right now. Climate is what happens over a very long average. A good definition I've heard is climate is the clothes that you buy. Weather is the clothes that you're wearing. It's like you prepare yourself for a climate.
So I want you to then sort of step into your students' minds and experiences. Like, how do you think they are understanding climate versus weather? Do you get a sense from them of like how they experience weather, climate, and its specificity to being in Missoula right now?
Yeah, I think it's fairly abstract for them, like what a norm should be. It's my non-traditional students, retirees sitting in with undergrads, sitting next to non-traditional students who are veterans, sitting next to, you know, whoever. And it's such a fun mix, but it's the non-traditional students who will raise their hands in class and be like, let me share with you what Montana was like in the 90s, 80s, 70s. My students, they know like they've seen the graphs, they know everything's changing, but they never lived during the Holocene, which is very emotional to tell them for me, because I was born at the very, very end of the Holocene. I saw the last normal year. And by the Holocene is the last 12,000 years of the Earth's climate. So the climate on Earth has changed forever. It always changes. It spikes really high, and we have the Cretaceous with palm trees in Alaska. And it spikes really low, and we have Snowball Earth because a bunch of volcanoes went off or whatever. But the last 12,000 years have been an unusually stable period in the Earth's climate. It's just like where kind of the cycles lined up. And we should be at the end of this period, we should be like slowly dipping into another ice age. We're supposed to be at the end of a warming period right now. So that we should be getting cooler ever so gradually. Of course, the opposite's happening. So we know it's unnatural. The Holocene, and this is debated by philosophers mostly, the Holocene ended at some point because we are no longer in a period when the natural cycles of the globe are the dominant climate drivers. Humans are now the dominant climate driver. Despite our tiny scale, we do more to the climate than any other cycle does. The last like normal year of the Holocene, if you take the averages of the Holocene, was like around 1989. So you and I saw the Holocene.
And it was beautiful.
It was beautiful. We built our first snow forts.
That's right.
During the Holocene. So when I share this with my students, I'm like, okay, all of you like 18 to 22 year olds, like you've actually never known a normal climate. You've seen a normal year. Because again, like climate fluctuates year to year. Like you're going to see a normal year now and then. But what you've seen is way more extremes than anything your parents grew up with. And the room gets very quiet when they realize they have like literally not even seen the epochal age of humans. They don't know what normal is.
I grew up in the Holocene in Alaska. Mm-hmm. 1989 was the Exxon Valdez oil spill,
yeah.
Right? Like that's when psychically I was like, oh. We're not where I thought we were, even as an 8-year-old, right? It became pretty apparent to me.
I've seen your talks, like you talk about the glacier, like right near your home.
So anyone who's spent time with me knows that so much of my work is done in relation to this body of ice. Again, I was born and raised in Southeast Alaska, and 3 miles from my childhood home lived Akwatoxie, which is the Tlingit name for the settler renamed Mendenhall Glacier. As a child, the glacier was 13 miles long and 1.5 miles wide at her snout. And growing up, most of my daily life took place within a 3-mile radius. So glaciers melt, it's what they do. And as a child, the glacier retreated at about 60 feet per year. When I left Alaska to go to college in 1999, the glacier began outpacing itself, retreating at about 400 feet per year. Between August of 2021 and 2022, it was 800 feet a year. By now, it's retreated over 1 mile in my lifetime, and it will be well out of sight when I reach retirement age. So it was about 7 years ago in 2017 that I was forced to face my own climate grief, the recognition that the glacier that I grew up with will cease to exist, at least in the visual plane.
The glacier was like a relative who was relatively stable, and it was just like, oh, that's grandma. She can still play pickleball. And then, you know, around 2000, it was like, no. Rapid decline and loss. And glaciers are like pre-inconvenient truth. Like, is like, oh, they should just be like pretty stable, lasting forces of nature who just like accumulate snow and then experience some ice loss and send off some cute little icebergs in the summer. And then, but like, it's so... It's been really wild to, I used to think I could fly north and I would still be in the Holocene, Peter.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a nice.
We used to teach people that too. I was like, oh, like just move poleward.
Yeah. It's that's like, it. Oh, go wait, to the Arctic. No,
the poles are getting hit harder.
What was it like for you when you started incorporating mental health into your classes? And how do you experience your own subjective reality while also providing objective information to students?
So my foray into it was terrifying because for two reasons. One, my way into it was a student attempting suicide because of climate change. There are other compounding factors there, of course, but that was sort of like this very harsh wake-up call. And I was brand new to the job. I was 2 months into my job as the CCS director. And she's doing very well now. She's good. So there's that like very hard push into it, like being shoved on stage when you haven't learned your lines yet. And I didn't know the play. I've never studied psychology. Mental health is not a part of my vocabulary. It wasn't at the time. Like, just like I found the people I knew who could speak that language, and I learned enough to at least start bringing it into it. My class. But my way into it was to not try to talk about grief, because I didn't have the vocabulary to. And if I did, I would botch it and potentially cause more harm. Like, this is the classic problem with mental health. Like, if you don't know what you're doing, you can cause more harm to the person than if you just let it lie. So my way into it was to try to help students empathize with climate deniers.
I want to pause on what Peter just said there. He told us that his way into addressing climate emotions in a classroom setting was to teach students how to empathize with climate deniers. I don't know if I've ever really put myself in the shoes of a climate denier, or someone who loves really hot weather, or ghost peppers, or snowmobilers. Have you really tried to step into the shoes of someone with such drastically different concrete beliefs than you? Peter told me that part of the strategy centers around the idea that denial is easier to understand than grief. We're all capable of denial, but grief is something we might not all have dealt with before or come to terms with. Once students started to think about how we're all capable of denial, they could be more empathetic towards how that denialism came to be. Can I just ask, like, what kinds of climate emotions do you live with?
All of them.
Give me a smattering. Can we name them for the audience?
Can we name... Psych 101, name your feelings.
Do you want the emoji chart of...
Yeah, do you have a day yeah. chart? Yeah, and I do this with my students too. On day one, I put up a big spectrum on the board and I have them like physically stand where they're feeling that day. And it can be anything from denial to I scream into the abyss. There's the obvious one of like wanting to just look away and distract. Not to the point of denial of like I'm pretending it doesn't exist. It's just like I need to not look at this right now, to like avid, vehement evangelism of like, I want to stand on the street corner and yell, like, why aren't you all, you're part of this world, like be a part of it. And then everything in between. I feel depressed. I feel hopeful. I feel in good community. I feel alone.
Beyond understanding that they've never seen the Holocene or a normal climate, Peter hopes his climate change study students figure out where they fit into the picture of climate change by finding what they're most passionate about. Passion can feel productive or even hopeful. Side note, hope is a buzzword that I struggle with, and it's something that I asked every guest about in this season of Grounding. But putting that aside for now, one way Peter has found hope during the climate crisis is through fatherhood.
I didn't have the language for this until one of my... students this past year who's Blackfeet spoke up, because there was a student saying like, I don't plan to have kids. I think we were like talking about hope or something, and this student spoke up and said like, no, like for my tradition, having children is hope. It's a way of saying like, the future isn't written yet. This child's going to write it and I'm going to help them. And so like choosing to have a child is hope. It's an act of hope. Hope is a verb.
I can't speak for Peter's son, but what I've noticed interviewing some of Peter's students is that they adore him. Something that sticks with his students is the way Peter ties humor into his classes. Peter says humor is honest. Humor breaks down barriers and pokes holes in people's defenses so that once they've relaxed, they can actually start to listen and learn.
Like if you look at climate change for more than 5 minutes, it's like, it's ridiculous that we are doing this to ourselves and that we still can't manage to pull ourselves out of this mess. So I think humor opens the door for that. And then students feel free to do that as well and be like, oh yeah, it's not just dark humor, but like, this is crazy. This is stupid. This is ridiculous. What can you do in the face of something like that except laugh and then cry and then laugh again?
Light, dark, light.
Light, dark, light. Yeah, it's a sandwich. It's Yes, it's an Oreo of humor.
Next, we're going to hear from Jen Robum, who teaches a mental health class within the Climate Change Studies program, which Peter directs.
My name's Jennifer Robum. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist and a university professor and a resident of Missoula. You know, I've been in Montana now for over 20 years, and certainly the winters feel different. There's this funny way where this summer is a good example where we hadn't had smoke up until a week ago. And there's a part of me that wants a little smoke, if only so folks will take climate change more seriously. But that's also this funny dissonance of wanting to enjoy things when they're going well and still hold on to the fact that we have a lot of work to do.
Just because you're an expert in the room, how would you define dissonance?
I think of it as when, you know, an experience is two things at once, or when we're holding on to two feelings or beliefs that are kind of bumping up against each other. You know, that, again, a disaster is terrible and it brings out the best in us, or the weather is beautiful, but why is it so hot?
Jen's pretty much a pro at talking about dissonance. She taught the first climate change and mental health studies class at the University of Montana. She's had two different cohorts, and in both, she's tried to supply students with tools to explore climate change-related emotions and distress. This is something I've experienced in all my conversations for grounding. It feels good just talking with others who also care and who are willing to share their feelings. Turns out, community is essential when tackling a wicked problem like climate change. Some of those tools from Jen involved outlawing cell phones, which helped connect students to each other by forcing more person-to-person interactions, and consequently, creating a safe space to talk about fear.
And I was looking around the room and they were laughing and smiling. And I said, you know, guys, what's going on here? And one of the young women turned around and she just looked at me and she said, it just feels so good to talk about it.
Jen also taught students about REPS, or resilience enhancement practices. REPS include things like a 5-minute meditation or taking a walk around the block. Things that can help recenter us when we're feeling overwhelmed. Students told Jen that the reps helped them manage climate distress and interactions with their friends and family. Jen advocated for trying a lot of reps. They're not a one-size-fits-all.
I encourage them to try everything on for size, but then to pick the ones that work best for you.
Jen, I was a mini guest lecturer in your class, and I witnessed you and your strong relationships with the students, and I was wondering, why is it important to you to form those kinds of bonds? And how does it speak to your experience with intergenerational collaboration?
You know, when I first started the class, my son was still a senior at U of M. And so in some ways, I felt like I was speaking to my own kid, which was great. And I know some of what he wrestles with and some of his fears about the future. So I think I could relate just in that way. I have some experience personally with that. But one of the things that struck me in the class, especially in the first year, a number of the students raised questions about whether people in my generation, people who are older, care about them. Because if we did, we would be doing something about climate change.
Jen, you and I have come to this work from different backgrounds. Can you talk a little bit about how you got engaged in this work, like your background, and why did you swing towards climate emotions?
You know, usually when I answer that question, I think about that summer in 2017, which so many of us just were blanketed by wildfire smoke. I remember looking across the street at my mailbox and not being able to see it over Labor Day weekend. And that was the first, I'd been worried about climate change and the environment for years, but that was the first time when I really recognized this is happening right now and it's going to impact our lives. And for me, the thing I worry most about is my son's future. You know, what will he be living with? And so, yeah, I've made it a priority for myself and in my work and try to weave it into everything that I do, because to me, it's the problem of our times.
How does the caregiving that you perform as a mom inform or differ from the caregiving you perform in the classroom?
You know, I think it's just recognizing we have responsibilities for the next generation, and we can't just be thinking about what we want or need right now. So there are plenty of times when I would love to maybe work a little bit less and not think about this thing and focus on other things that make me feel happier and more joyful. But I feel like I have a responsibility to him and to them to be trying to do my best for them.
Lastly, let's hear from three students, Vivi, Michael, and Lauren, all who study within the Climate Change Studies program.
My name's Vivi, Vivian Ostheimer. I'm from Buffalo, Wyoming, and I'm studying journalism and environmental science with a minor in climate change studies.
Hi, my name is Lauren Schulte. I'm originally from Spokane, Washington, and I am a senior at the University of Montana this year. I am majoring in psychology and also minoring in climate change studies.
My name is Michael Jump. I am from Highlands Ranch, Colorado. I am a senior. I'm studying environmental science and nonprofit administration.
Although I've only been in Missoula for, I guess, 3 full years now, I noticed similar patterns from when I was growing up in Spokane, for sure. And I think the biggest difference that I've noticed most recently is sort of the transition between seasons feels like it lasts longer.
Yeah, I think about my freshman year here, and there was past like December, basically no snow. The entire spring was pretty dry. And last year was a little different. Last year we got hit pretty heavy for like a month, but like you said, it was an abbreviated season. By March, everyone was outside by March. So not exactly what I expected coming to Montana. In Colorado, we've been getting a lot of similar seasons to that, where it's like we'll get hit hard for a month of winter, but then it's 80 degrees in March. So I have grown kind of used to the weird unpredictability, but kind of like predictable short seasons at the same time.
Yeah, to go off of that unpredictability element, I feel like that's where I've seen the most change. It's just there's these like climate weirding events kind of where it's not something that we normally see, but we're seeing it almost on a normal basis. And I think about, I wasn't around last summer, but I had some friends who lived in Missoula, and during that huge windstorm, a tree fell on one of their houses. And that's just something that we're seeing everywhere more often.
Climate weirding, or global weirding, as a term, came from a study focused on how urban areas are impacted by climate change. One of the authors used it to summarize how cities in the study are changing, but not always in a predictable way. And in an urban context, those back and forths can be really hard to deal with when water supplies and old infrastructure can't handle the swings. The windstorm Vivi brought up that tore through Missoula in the summer of 2024 was a great example of climate weirding, as was the algae in the Clark Fork that I talked about earlier. Top wind speeds reached over 100 miles per hour at the peak of a mountain in town. Meteorologists described it as a derecho, a storm with a disaster wake comparable to a hurricane in a landlocked state. As Peter reminded us, these students have never experienced a normal climate, but they have felt and noticed a change, and in some cases, it's compelled them to action. Here's Lauren.
I wasn't really involved in the climate community much until my sophomore year of high school. And then one random day, one of my friends asked me if I wanted to skip class for a climate strike. And I spontaneously just decided to leave high school and go to downtown Spokane and join this climate strike. And that sort of really like turned on a light bulb in my brain. I remember leaving that climate strike feeling like more empowered and more passionate about something than I ever had before.
It can feel good to feel good about something bad. I know that sounded weird, but it makes sense, especially if you're in community like Lauren was during the climate strike. That's a good way of thinking about dissonance. And Michael's no stranger to that feeling.
I started to grow in my faith as a Christian, and I started learning more about how all of these climate issues are also people issues. They're scientific and ecological, but there's human health aspects, and all of, you know, everyone who I consider to be my neighbor is going to be impacted by this. So what can I do to start mitigating and helping my community adapt to this? It was kind of my entry point. It's a difficult place to be sometimes for me as a person of faith who also cares about climate issues, because in this country, that those groups don't usually overlap. And I find such a strong basis in my faith and in scripture for my beliefs about climate change and what should be done about these environmental issues. But there's kind of a dissonance there where people just don't see it the same way as I do.
And like Vivi, they've been afraid to lose the places they love to its weirdings.
I just feel such a deep sense of attachment to the nature that I live within. So I don't want to lose any of it. Yeah, in Peter's intro class, Intro to Climate Change, he gives us an action project that we have to do. So you have to pick something that's climate focused and do your own project on it. And I think that going into that, I didn't know how big of a change I could make personally. I knew I could bike to school and participate in clubs, but just having the opportunity to take action on something really gave me a sense of agency and efficacy. And I ended up writing a grant proposal to bring composting to my apartment complex. I live in some student apartments at UM. And that just made me feel so much better about everything, that I could do something. And as I watched people start to participate in my program and talk to people who were curious about composting and wanted to learn more, I realized that everyone wants to do something and make a change, but it's just hard to get started and it can feel overwhelming and paralyzing. But when people feel that sense of agency, I think action is our most powerful tool.
Yeah, I would agree in the sense that if you let it, this topic will just debilitate your existence. And I find myself in the difficult spot of how much do I let this affect me to be able to really take it in, and how much do I, unfortunately, sometimes have to put it aside to just continue my daily existence. And I think that's the part that bothers me the most. And so as a college student, I really do try to engage in small action, like only riding my bike or taking the bus to campus every day, or thanks to Vivi, composting in my apartment, or I don't use plastic bags when I pack my lunch, or in high school, I decided to stop eating beef.
Remember when Peter encouraged his students to empathize with climate deniers?
Yeah, I feel like I lived this exercise for 18 years. And yeah, if there's one thing I learned, it's that you just have to be curious about why people feel the way they do, because everyone has emotion tied to it and history is tied to it, and no one's opinion should be disregarded or thought of as wrong because it's different than yours.
And yet, somehow, they don't express anger towards those who might not think the same way they do, or towards generations older than them. They approach the dialogue with grace and with an invitation for others to join them. You are all young adults. But I want to ask the question, what do you want older generations, other adults, to know?
Climate change is actually something that I've talked to my grandpa about a lot. I'm very lucky to have a grandfather that is very open to ideas that are not consistent with the ideas that he grew up in. And talking to him about climate change has really opened my eyes to how the older generation is conceptualizing these issues. And I think I would just, from what I've learned from him and through conversations with older individuals in my life, I think it's just important to note that it might seem like we're being left with this burning pile of garbage to clean up, but in a lot of ways, I think the older generation feels sorry for that, and they feel the impacts and see how their actions have impacted the younger generation.
I think Lauren's right. This is all of our problem, and we're younger, so we'll be around a little bit longer to deal with it. But everyone has a place in climate action, and we've all contributed in one way or another. And I think our generation knows even more and has a lot of fire.
A way that we can connect with the older generation as younger people is framing these climate issues as people issues and saying, listen, this is something that's going to impact me and my family and every family around me. Like, it's not your fault. No person in my parents' or grandparents' generation is responsible for all that is to come. But they do have a place in climate action going forward. For any of our climate action to become a larger scale, like systems level change, it's going to take a lot more than just our generation.
That was University of Montana student Michael Jump, inviting everyone into the climate movement from all ages, backgrounds, and perspectives. Next episode, I'll be exploring why we assume people don't care about the environment and how the Finnish language can help us put words to complex feelings. Grounding is hosted by me, Sarah Aronson. Keely Larson is our executive producer. Editorial support from Lauren Korn and Claire Menahan. Engineering by Chris Moyles. Thanks to Michael Marsalek and Nick Mott. The theme song is by Brian Ramirez. Grounding is a production of Montana Public Radio.